Chapter 10. The Law Matures. Abridged excerpt. This chapter continues the theme of the two preceding chapters, with special attention to three trials of the late 1920s and early 1930s. At this stage, loyal engineers and even fellow communists come under attack. End of abridgment excerpt. And may my compassionate reader now have mercy on me. Until now, my pen sped on, untrembling, my heart didn't skip a beat, and we slipped along unconcerned, because for these 15 years we have been firmly protected either by legal revolutionality or else by revolutionary legality. But from now on, things will be painful. As the reader will recollect, as we have explained to us a dozen times, beginning with Khrushchev, from approximately 1934, violations of Leninist norms of legality began. And how are we to enter this abyss of illegality now? How are we to drag our way along yet another bitter stretch of the road? However, these trials which follow were, because of the fame of the defendants, a cynosure for the whole world. They did not escape the attention of the public. They were written about. They were interpreted, and they will be interpreted again and again. It is for us merely to touch lightly on their riddle. Let us make one qualification, though not a big one. The published stenographic records did not coincide completely with what was said at the trials. One writer who received an entrance pass, they were given out only to selected individuals, took running notes and subsequently discovered these differences. All the correspondents also noted the snag with Krasinski, which made a recess necessary in order to get him back on the track of his assigned testimony. Here is how I picture it. Before the trial, a chart was set up for emergencies. In the first column was the name of the defendant. In the second, the method to be used during the recess if he should depart from his text during the open trial. In the third column, the name of the Czechist responsible for applying this... the name of the Czechist responsible for applying the indicated method. So if Krasinski departed from his text, then who would come on the run and what that person would do had already been arranged. But the inaccuracies of the stenographic record do not change or lighten the picture. Dumbfounded, the world watched three plays in a row, three wide-ranging and expensive dramatic productions in which the powerful leaders of the fearless Communist Party, who had turned the entire world upside down and terrified it, now marched forth like doleful, obedient goats and bleated out everything they had been ordered to, vomited over themselves, cringingly abased themselves and their convictions, and confessed to crimes they could not in any wise have committed. This was unprecedented in remembered history. It was particularly astonishing in contrast with the recent Leipzig trial of Dmitriev. Dmitriev had answered the Nazi judges like a roaring lion, and, immediately afterward, his comrades in Moscow, members of that same unyielding cohort which had made the whole world tremble, and the greatest of them at that, those who had been called the Leninist Guard, came before the judges drenched in their own urine. And even though much appears to have been clarified since then, with particular success by Arthur Kessler, the riddle continues to circulate as durably as ever. People have speculated about a Tibetan potion that deprives a man of his will, and about the use of hypnosis. Such explanations must by no means be rejected. If the NKVD possessed such methods, clearly there were no moral rules to prevent resorting to them. Why not weaken or muddle the will? And it is a known fact that in the 20s some leading hypnotists gave up their careers and entered the service of the GPU. It is also reliably known that in the 30s a school for hypnotists existed in the NKVD. Kamenev's wife was allowed to visit her husband before his trial and found him not himself. His reactions retarded, and she managed to communicate this to others before she herself was arrested. But why was neither Polchinski nor Krasinnikov broken by the Tibetan potion or hypnosis? The fact is that an explanation on a higher psychological plane is called for. One misunderstanding in particular results from the image of these men as old revolutionaries who had not trembled in Tsarist dungeons, seasoned, tried and true, hardened, etc. fighters. But there is a plain and simple mistake here. These defendants were not those old revolutionaries. They had acquired that glory by inheritance from and association with the Narodniks, the Asars, and the Anarchists. They were the ones, the bomb-throwers and the conspirators, who had known hard labor imprisonment and real prison terms. But even they had never in their lives experienced a genuinely merciless interrogation, because such a thing did not exist at all in Tsarist Russia. And these others, the Bolshevik defendants at these treason trials, had never known either interrogation or real prison terms. The Bolsheviks had never been sentenced to special dungeons, any Sakhalin, any special hard labor in Yakutsk. It is well known that Dzerzhinsky had the hardest time of them all, and that he spent all his life in prisons. But according to our yardstick, he had served just a normal tenor, just a simple 10-ruble bill, like any ordinary collective farmer in our time. True, included in that tenor were 3 years in the hard labor central prison, but that is nothing special either. The party leaders, who were the defendants in the trials of 1936 to 1938, had, in their revolutionary pasts, known short, easy imprisonment, short periods in exile, and had never even had a whiff of hard labor. Bukharin had many petty arrests on his record, but they amounted to nothing. Apparently, he was never imprisoned anywhere for a whole year at a time, and he had just a wee bit of exile on Oniga. Kamenev, despite long years of propaganda work and travel to all cities of Russia, spent only 2 years imprisoned and 1.5 years in exile. In our time, even 16-year-old kids got 5 right off. Zinoviev, believe it or not, never spent as much as 3 months in prison. He never received even 1 sentence. In comparison with the ordinary natives of our archipelago, they were all callow youths. They didn't know what prison was like. Rykov and I.N. Smirnov had been arrested several times and had been imprisoned for 5 years, but somehow they went through prison very easily, and they either escaped from exile without any trouble at all, or were released because of an amnesty. Until they were arrested and imprisoned in the Libyanka, they hadn't the slightest idea what a real prison was, nor what the jaws of unjust interrogation were like. There is no basis for assuming that if Trotsky had fallen into those jaws, he would have conducted himself with any less self-abasement, or that his resistance would have proved stronger than theirs. He had no occasion to prove it. He, too, had known only easy imprisonment, no serious interrogations, and a mere 2 years of exile in Uskut. The terror Trotsky inspired as chairman of the Revolutionary Military Council was something he acquired very cheaply, and does not at all demonstrate any true strength of character or courage. Those who have condemned many others to be shot often wilt at the prospect of their own death. The two kinds of toughness that are not connected. And, after all, our entire failure to understand derives from our belief in the unusual nature of these people. We do not, after all, where ordinary confessions signed by ordinary citizens are concerned, find their reasons for denouncing themselves and others so fulsomely baffling. We accept it as something we understand. A human being is weak, a human being gives in. But we consider Bukharin, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Pyatakov, I.N. Smirnov to be supermen to begin with, and, in essence, our failure to understand is due to that fact alone. True, the directors of this dramatic production seem to have had a harder task in selecting the performers than they'd had in the earlier trials of the engineers. In those trials, they had 40 barrels to pick from, so to speak, whereas here the available troupe was small. Everyone knew who the chief performers were, and the audience wanted to see them in the roles and them only. Yet there was a choice. The most far-sighted and determined of those who were doomed did not allow themselves to be arrested. They committed suicide first. Skripnik, Tomsky, Gemernik. It was the ones who wanted to live who allowed themselves to be arrested. And one could certainly braid a rope from the ones who wanted to live. But even among them, some behaved differently during the interrogations. Realizing what was happening, turned stubborn, and died silently, but at least not shamefully. For some reason, they did not, after all, put on public trial Rudzitik, Postchev, Yenudkids, Chubar, Kosier, and, for that matter, Krylenko himself. even though their names would have embellished the trials. They put on trial the most compliant. A selection was made after all. The men selected were drawn from a lower order, but, on the other hand, the mustached producer knew each of them very well. He also knew that on the whole they were weaklings. And he knew, one by one, the particular weaknesses of each. Therein lay his dark and special talent, his main psychological bent and his life's achievement, to see people's weaknesses on the lowest plane of being. And the man who seems, in the perspective of time, to have embodied the highest and brightest intelligence of all the disgraced and executed leaders, and to whom Arthur Kessler apparently dedicated his talented inquiry, was N.I. Bukharin. Stalin saw through him, too, at that lowest stratum at which the human being unites with the earth, and Stalin held him in a long death grip, playing with him as a cat plays with a mouse, letting him go just a little, and then catching him again. Bukharin wrote every last word of our entire existing, in other words, non-existent, constitution, which is so beautiful to listen to. And he flew about up there, just below the clouds, and thought that he had outplayed Koba, that he had thrust a constitution on him that would compel him to relax the dictatorship, and at that very moment he himself had already been caught in those jaws. Bukharin, in his last days, began to compose his letter to the future Central Committee. Committed to memory and thereby preserved, it recently became known to the whole world. However, it did not shake the world to its foundations, for what were the last words this brilliant theoretician decided to hand down to future generations? Just one more cry of anguish and a plea to be restored to the party. He paid dearly in shame for that devotion. And one more affirmation that he fully approved everything that had happened up to and including 1937. And that included not only all the previous jeeringly mocking trials, but also all the foul-smelling waves of our great prison sewage disposal system. There remained an easy dialogue with Vyshinsky along set lines. Is it true that every opposition to the party is a struggle against the party? In general, it is. Factually, it is. But a struggle against the party cannot help but grow into a war against the party. According to the logic of things, yes, it must. And that means that in the end, given the existence of oppositionist beliefs, any foul deeds whatever might be perpetrated against the party, espionage, murder, sellout of the motherland. But wait a minute, none were actually committed. But they could have been? Well, theoretically speaking, those are your theoreticians for you. But for us, the highest of all interests are those of the party? Yes, of course. Of course. So you see, only a very fine distinction separates us. We are required to concretize the eventuality. In the interest of discrediting for the future any idea of opposition, we are required to accept as having taken place what could only theoretically have taken place. After all, it could have, couldn't it? It could have. And so it is necessary to recognize as actual what was possible. That's all. It's a small philosophical transition. Are we in agreement? Yes, and one thing more, and it's not for me to explain to you, but if you retreat and say something different during the trial, you understand that will only play into the hands of the world bourgeoisie and will only do the party harm. Well, and it's clear that in that case you yourself will not die an easy death. But if everything goes off all right, we will, in the course, allow you to go on living. We'll send you in secret to the island of Monte Cristo, and you can work on the economics of socialism there. But in previous trials, as I understand it, did you shoot them all? But what comparison is there between you and them? And then, we also left many of them alive, too. They were only shot in the newspapers. And so perhaps there isn't any insoluble riddle in those trials. End of chapter 10.